we are going to, this session is on the origins of women's oppression, and Eleanor is going to introduce this as a kind of about 30 minute introduction, and then there'll be time for questions, comments, etc. And also just kind of, why are we having this discussion now? What does that mean as socialists, and what does that mean in terms of what we might want to do and change in the future as well? So I'll pass over to Eleanor Don, okay. Who's from Bathurst branch and is a member of the Socialist Women National Committee.
Right, thank you. I might stand up if that doesn't look too sort of, domineering. This is kind of easier. I'll start with Darwin, actually, because, there's been quite a lot of material about Darwin, and there is a discussion this afternoon relating to him. Obviously a genius in the world of natural science. But unfortunately, like many scientists straying into the wrong field, had some views on women, which I'll quote something which will make that clear. He said in his Descent of Man that through natural selection, men became superior in courage, intellect, energy and inventive genius. Women's qualities of intuition, perception and imitation are inferior qualities, and I quote, characteristic of the lower races and therefore of the past and lower state of civilization, which we clearly wouldn't agree with. So in spite of what he achieved, I think what that shows is this idea of social Darwinism, which, I mean, in a sense he subscribed to himself, but has become dominant since then. It's misapplying the concept of evolution, really, to social structures and situations in society. And in some ways, science was sort of added on to religion as a primary ideological tool, often of the ruling class, to kind of keep women and the lower orders in their place and to try and explain and justify their oppression. And religion obviously does still play a major role in parts of the world in the oppression of women, especially where the economic systems are based on a rural economy, still basically a feudal system. Some of the Islamic states that are now, in some ways, were previously secular states, have now become religious states again. Sharia law and so on in Islam is an indication of this. But also in the US, where you've got the the Christian fundamentalists, who have been a very powerful anti-abortion, pro-creationist lobby. But in addition to sort of religion, which has blamed women for the fall of the human race from paradise, that's something we've, now science is proving women to be biologically inferior, and that's, the idea of social Darwinism. And at the time, I mean, they were coming out with stuff like, well, your brains are physically smaller, even that body cells are different. There was a book called Evolution of Sex, which came out in 1889, which said that male cells were active and energising, women's cells are passive and life-supporting, and, in other words, sort of every part of a man was sort of aggressive and competitive, and women were placid. And what it did, really, is it just reflected the roles that were expected of men and women, particularly those of the middle and upper classes in Victorian England. There was a guy which people might have heard of called Herbert Spencer, who espoused these ideas, that the idea that we have a fixed fund of energy, and that because women have to use that for reproduction, then they haven't got enough left over for things like thinking and intellectual activity. And it does sound ridiculous now, but they did put out dire warnings against higher education for women, saying that it would shrivel your wombs, and these are the sort of, there's a book which I haven't brought with me, actually. It's called Female Madness by Elaine Showalter, which goes into a lot of those ideas. But I think, in a way, we've got a new tool, really, of social Darwinism is genetics. And I think in the last decade, that has given a kind of a boost, in a way, to what the ideas of what's called evolutionary psychology, which is basically explaining often quite complex social structures and behaviours, and saying that it's genetically determined. And this is a subject of debate. You know, it's by no means accepted by most geneticists, actually, who say, well, no, we can't apply those ideas to things like why men don't do the ironing, and that, you know, there is a book out sort of to do that, why men don't iron. But there is another book which I think, on a more serious note, is quite worrying, called The Natural History of Rape, which argues that rape is an evolutionary adaptive behaviour. It's adaptive, or it's a kind of byproduct of this drive of males to procreate, and it promotes the idea that the dominant male, you know, got more sex, procreated more, even by force, so therefore were selected for sexual aggression. And in a way, it's a rerun of the old sort of naked ape idea from the 70s. I don't know if I certainly remember that with Desmond Morris. But there's plenty of evidence from, you know, anthropology and so on, that male jealousy and competitiveness and aggression, it would actually be a very poor adaptive behaviour, you know, in evolutionary terms, that human babies are actually born at an early stage of development. They're quite helpless. They need a long childhood and long period of care. For humans to survive, you know, most anthropologists accept that we needed group child rearing and food gathering. That was how human society developed. And that cooperation was what was needed, and anything that threatened the group solidarity was actually threatening the survival of the human race. And I haven't really got time wanted to go into that in any great depth, but I'll put a couple of things up here which I'll point comrades to, which I think, you know, which is part of this debate that's going on at the moment about really an answer, in a way, to some of the ideas that says that men are inherently aggressive and so on. The Radical Anthropology Group, if you just sort of Google it, actually, it will come up with some information. And there's a new book out, Mothers and Others, which hopefully will get the bookshop to order, actually, but which goes into these ideas in more detail. But clearly, on the sort of biological differences issue, or clearly there are biological differences between men and women. I mean, when, you know, the main one being that women do give birth to babies and are, you know, feed babies, which men at the moment, you know, don't. But obviously at the moment, I think women are avoiding, in a way, this kind of biological destiny, because they're not having kids, or they're having them a lot later. You know, this idea that you can't combine, it means giving up so much that you put off having children until a lot later. But why should this very important productive activity of having children, why has that meant that we've ended up as second class citizens? And I would argue it's not inherent in the role of childbirth, it's the way that the workplace, the whole role of work, the family and society is constructed. Women have campaigned and men, you know, the trade union movement have campaigned for maternity leave and maternity rights to try and overcome these difficulties. But when it suits the ruling class to have women in the workforce, such as during a war, you know, they will make sure that they organise society so that that can happen. They'll, overnight, you know, you'll have access to workplace nurseries and so on. And I think it would be wrong to say that we're determined by our biology. It's a feature of human society. One of the main features is consciousness. You know, we are able to, through culture and capacity to use technology, we're able to shape and to some extent destroy our environment as well, obviously, and not just be shaped by it in a passive way. And currently, societies is organised in a way which suits the ruling class, which in our part of the world is a capitalist economy. The bedrock of that really is the family, you know, the nuclear family. And most different aspects of women's oppression, the kind of double standards when you're judging men and women's sexual behaviour, the way that women are judged more for their looks and not for what they think or say, all sorts of, I mean, you know, there's quite a long list really, or even, you know, why women are low paid. Why do we have domestic violence and rape? The aspect of control of women's fertility. all of these different aspects of oppression have their origin really in the patriarchal family, which patriarchal basically means male dominated, or the man as the head of household, the economic provider with a dependent wife and children. I mean, the word for family is actually from the Latin from Roman society, which didn't describe a personal relationship, it described actually what the man owned, including slaves, land, wife, children. You know, it was actually it clearly wasn't just based on sort of personal choice and so on. It described a social institution. And, I mean, incidentally, in the Roman family, by that stage, the man had absolute power over, to the point of life and death, over his wife and children and slaves, you know, and that was... And this Roman family, if you like, the patriarchal family, became a model for much of Europe because of the Roman Empire, which up to the 5th century AD was, you know, conquered much of Europe. But the family isn't something that's always been with us. It's was only really fully established round about 5,000 years ago, which obviously is a long time, you know, in terms of our how long we live and so forth. But in terms of human history, it's quite recent. I mean, if we think about roughly 100,000 years of human history, that's... That's the whole of human history. The family is about 9,000, 10,000 years, which is about there. So, you know, most of that time we haven't spent living in families. But by the time of sort of the Old Testament and so forth, that, you know, the patriarchal family was established, and this represents the situation in one part of the Middle East, really, where this, you know, civilization, if you like, developed, where society developed based on slavery and agriculture and animal herding. But the family, I'll come back to that in a minute, but the family also has differences. It's not the same everywhere, and it's organised differently. Under capitalism, it's an economic unit where ideally for them they want one person paying a wage to one person, and everything else comes out of, you know, all the care of the children as much as possible comes out of that one wage, because that saves society money. They don't want to be paying out for things like looking after children and education. Under feudal societies, the family is more like a unit of production where you've got everyone working in the fields to produce the crops. So there are differences in the family which reflect how the economy is run. But the ruling class will always try and make out their system and structures out to be the natural way. You know, they imply that, well, it's always been this way, but as you can see, you know, for 90% of our history, it hasn't been that way. But mostly, you know, I mean, I'm not an anthropologist and I've never claimed to be one, but I think it's fair to say that on the evidence that is around, it's accepted that early human society, what we would call hunter-gatherer society, it had some common features, one of which was group living, that although, you know, people did pair up and such in the groups, their main relationship and responsibility was to their group or clan or whatever you call it, tribe. And another feature of these societies is that there were no hierarchies, that you didn't have a class system. Basically, everyone was pretty much, you know, equal in terms of status. There might have been people who were revered because of age, knowledge, and so on, but it didn't reflect in their having more belongings, more food, anything like that. Generally, that women and men were of equal status, that there was a division of labour, but that didn't imply that it meant that one was more valued than the other, and I will come back to that in a minute. But the other thing was that children were generally looked after communally, so although it was recognised that they knew who their mother was, but, you know, in terms of how it was structured, everybody was responsible for them, and the concept of paternity wasn't really seen as important because your main relationship was with the mother and the mother's clan. And the other feature was there was no concept of private property, that anything that was tracked or hunted or gathered or found was belonged to the whole group. And there is quite a lot of, you know, there's sort of quite a lot of anecdotal evidence where clearly the idea of private property, when these anthropologists went out to various hunter-gatherer societies, they just thought it was really strange that we didn't have, like this one where they asked the anthropologist, well, what would you do if you found something valuable? And they couldn't get the concept that he wouldn't automatically share it with everyone, because that was what was, it's not so idealised, it was because that was what was required. You couldn't, human society couldn't have survived if you didn't have, you know, everything that was gathered was used by, if people didn't have access to the food, because it was quite a basic existence. Now, I'll just give a plug at this point for Frederick Engels' book, The Origin of Family, Private Property in the State, which I've got here. We've got more, slightly more modern-looking ones on the bookstall, which Engels was, as some of you probably know, was collaborated with Karl Marx. You know, he was a Marxist, if you like, and he wrote the book based on Marx's notes and also based on the research of an anthropologist, mainly one anthropologist called Lewis Morgan. And I think, although, you know, anthropology in some ways has moved on, I think there still it's recognised as very valid as a good analysis of how we went from hunter-gatherer, what Engels called primitive communism in a way, to the patriarchal family. So he looked at common features amongst sort of existing hunter-gatherer societies and said that these aren't just sort of quirky local customs. He looked at, brought a Marxist analysis to it and looked at their mode of production. He looked at the societies that were around and looked at what their mode of production was, how they survived, you know, whether looked at that in relation to the how the family was structured. And what happened really was where societies moved to agriculture and production and also herding, you know, the domestication of animals, that meant that it was possible to have surplus food and surplus wealth in society, and that is where you get the beginnings of hierarchy, and you get evidence of the family, the male, you know, the patriarchal family. I realise I'm going a bit slow here, but the development of this didn't happen sort of everywhere. So what happened? You know, you've still today got hunter-gatherer societies, but in particularly in the Middle East, it probably first happened, but also independently in America as well. You had the development of agriculture in a sort of particularly fertile area. And this led to, I'm not going to go into this in a great deal of detail because I haven't got time really, but we have got in our Introduction to Marxism pack, which is also on the bookstall, there's the Marxist View of History, which goes into quite a lot of detail explaining how societies based on slavery developed. But I will just focus on a couple of questions which I think are especially relevant to this meeting. Because as you got surplus wealth, you then found you got a division of labour within the settled tribes, and you did get an emergence for the first time of certain groups whose interests were different from the rest. You know, unlike before, where everything that you got you shared because that was essential. If you have a surplus, then you don't need to do that. It frees up certain people to do different jobs. And over a process of a long time, I mean, we're talking, you know, thousands of years, certain of these groups came to see the wealth as theirs, you know, the cattle as theirs, rather than belonging to their tribe. But again, as I say, that's explained in more detail in this Marxist view of history. But the question I think that is quite relevant for us in a way is how and why did this new wealth and status seem to end up with men? And why did women resist? What happened, you know, how did we end up in this situation? So I think the new wealth, it didn't end up in the hands of all men. You know, what it meant was you had a hierarchy. It means that you've only got certain individual men who end up rich. So the vast majority of men, they ended up as slaves and as serfs and peasants. And so it's not to say that it applies to everyone, but nevertheless, I think it's a question that needs looking at. And I think mostly the explanation seems to come from the fact that there was an existing division of labour between men and women in hunter-gatherer societies, which, as I said before, didn't imply that one was more valued than the other. I mean, in some ways, obviously childbirth and rearing in a hunter-gatherer society was something that was extremely important, vital to human survival, and there is some evidence to show that it was quite a revered process. But what happened, I mean, but generally speaking, men were more responsible for hunting. So societies where they went from hunting to capturing animals to then domesticating animals, that was the men's labour, if you like, that's what they did. So that meant that when you started to have cattle that you just looked after, that became the men's property. And cattle, it wasn't just for meat. I mean, cattle really was the first commodity for exchange. You know, it was it became wealth in that sense. It's something you keep, and you can either exchange for other things. So it became what we would see as wealth in a way. Also, I mean, there is some evidence to show that sort of men were that linked to hunting was use of weapons, bows and arrows, and so forth. Generally speaking, men had the job of defending the tribe or the group, partly because because of our biology in a sense, but childbirth and child rearing was very important. Also, if a woman got killed, that was quite a tragedy for a hunter-gatherer group, because obviously, to put it bluntly, a man can produce lots of children with you could have several men and one woman, and a man would be more expendable. I don't mean that in a judgmental way, but in terms of evolution in that kind of society, women were more important to be sort of defended. So you had this situation where women sort of owned the tools that they used for their work, men owned the tools that they used for their work, which when it's a bow and arrow, it's not really very significant. When it becomes cattle that you own and it's wealth, then that's obviously much more important. And then that led on to what happened with society. Because you have surplus wealth, then you're more likely to feel you have to defend that wealth as well. So the other thing was that hunter-gatherer societies were generally what was called matrilocal, that the man moved to the woman's clan on marriage, that was just generally speaking. I mean, that maybe wasn't the case in all of them. And generally speaking, matrilineal, which means that the children belonged to the mother's clan, and that were this idea of paternity. I mean, whether or not people knew who their father was, it wasn't really an issue, because your relationship was with the clan, which was through your mother. And obviously, this wasn't a problem as such. You know, it wasn't. It was worked perfectly fine in a way for thousands of years. But once you've got a situation where the father has perhaps got some cattle wealth status that he wants to pass down to his children, then that's where you get the tension between the idea of individual wealth and the group. And you also get the importance of paternity. You need to know who your children are in order to pass your wealth on. And what that meant was that you can see the development of societies where inheritance became passed down through the male line, went from what they call matrilineal to patrilineal, and also the removal of the right of women to end a relationship, because then she might return with her children to her own clan, and that would mean the father hasn't got his children to pass wealth on to. But the third thing, and perhaps the most significant in a way, is that it required that monogamy, strict monogamy in a way, so that you had the fathers knew who their children were. Because obviously you know who your children are if you're the woman, you've given birth to them, but how do you know if you're the father? And the way you know is that you make sure that the woman can't have sex with anyone else, to put it bluntly, and that's how that came about. And so you needed strict monogamy for women, but it didn't really matter for men, and that's where this double standard originated. And Engels called this the world historical defeat of humankind, of womankind. Now, did this question of did women resist? Because obviously, if it's a world historical defeat of womankind, how did that happen? You go from being relatively revered in a society to being absolutely, a slave in the patriarchal Roman societies. And I think the first point is that women who were first affected, or most affected by this change, would have been in the group which had a surplus, which were part of the growing elite, in a way, because, as I say, it was uneven. Not all the groups had wealth. A lot of them were still hunter-gathering. So it was double-edged. In some ways, they benefited because increased comfort. You didn't have to work quite so hard. You might have had slaves to do work for you. Your interests were partially tied in with a system of private property and class division. And so therefore, the women would have faced a conflict which is still there today in a way that, that women of the upper class would face, that there's a conflict between the interests of their gender, if you like, and the interests of their class, and that whilst there is some evidence of revolt amongst, once you got to, the Roman state, there's records of women demonstrating against attempts to restrict their clothing, what they could wear and what they couldn't, and so forth. But the other thing is, I think we're talking thousands of years, really, and it's not like something happened overnight and people would have had a chance to revolt, perhaps if they saw what the consequences were. It wouldn't have been clear at the start of the process how it was going to end. It was, generations and generations of people. But this idea of the division of labour between I'll just put quotes mending. See, this idea of a division of labour between men and women in hunter-gatherer societies, some feminists have said, there's a sort of quite a crossover between socialism and feminism in terms of what's fundamental to women's oppression. And one of the things that some aspects of feminism would emphasise is, their view is that women's oppression was evident well before class society, and that's why they say that it's not actually that the patriarchy, if you like, came first and then class came second. And one of the reasons they say that is because of this division of labour between men and women. But again, I would come back to the point that different roles don't necessarily, and probably didn't, mean lower status. There's no evidence really that women had a lower status. Child rearing wasn't seen as second class. It was vital for survival, and the task of gathering, which mainly fell to women, in a lot of tribes, three quarters of their food came from that. It was a vital activity that women were doing. also, it wasn't in the same way that we think of now, where you're just stuck in your own kitchen cooking and you're removed from public life. It was, society was organised much more communally, and the women were sort of in the, not individual, it was like communal households. So they were there much more in the public sphere, you know. So it wasn't the same. But I think, you know, we would accept, I mean, I'll just draw your attention to the quote from Engels, that the first class opposition that appears in history coincides with the development of the antagonism between men and women in monogamous marriage. And the first class oppression coincides with that of the female sex by the male. You know, I think we recognise as Marxists that the two are intertwined, but they developed, the family developed out of the needs of a class society to pass on their wealth. And that you, but what's fundamental to us then is that you need to remove the root cause, which is the classes, the division of society into classes, which doesn't mean that you completely ignore the issue of women's oppression and you just say, well, we'll fight for socialism and everything will be fine. We do, you know, it's very, very important to campaign and fight on issues that affect women specifically. But ultimately, we would say that, you know, fortunately, I don't think there are genetic and biological reasons why we've got all the divisions in society that we have. Because if that were true, then it's quite a pessimistic view on life, really, because it means you can't change it at all. And I would say that there are, you know, massive possibilities that can be opened up again. Engels' book was, in itself, when it came out, it was a scathing attack, really, on the bourgeois morals of the time. He called it marriage open or concealed domestic slavery and legalised prostitution, and he completely punctured the myth of the Victorian family. But it was more than that, in a way. It was a very dangerous idea, because it showed that there was a time when women weren't second-class citizens, and furthermore, that we lived in a kind of egalitarian way, that we didn't have to, you know, there haven't always been classes and rich and poor, and that therefore it opened up the possibility that you can have that again, but not based on society where we're just scraping by, we haven't got, you know, you've barely got enough to live on, so not primitive communism in a sense, but a higher mode of production in a socialist society which draws on, if you like, the achievements of civilisation, albeit that was at a massive cost to the vast majority of women and men. You build on that and it opens up the possibility of going back in a way to how, you know, the equality between men and women and between, you know, all of us really, but and removing personal relationships from that kind of the fetters of money, property, all the things which still affect us. Because just last point, in a way, that we obviously for us now in this, you know, in the kind of advanced capitalist West, it, on the face of it, it looks as if we're free to choose our own partners, to have relationships, end relationships. You know, no one's going to lock you up for getting divorced and so on. However, I found a statistic the other day which is saying that apparently divorce rates have dipped in the last couple of years. And probably the main reason for that is that house prices have gone down and people can't afford to, you know, obviously it's a split in property, you can't afford to get divorced. And I think that just shows that there still is an economic unit, really, isn't it? The family. And that what we want to try and do, I think, is not abolished family, as in we've all got to live in communes, but to remove the economic and social pressures which force us together in a way, and so that it will be a genuine choice, and to have a relationship, leave a relationship, and that it won't have the economic and social implications that it does today. Sorry, it went on a bit.